Welcome to Treasure Mountain, the podcast that inspires and guides people to find the treasure within human experience. I'm your host, Sol Hanna. On this episode of Spirit Stories, we have as our guest, Ayat Tataloka from Aranyabodhi Awakening Forest Hermitage in California. Ayat Tataloka was born in Washington, D.C. in 1968 to environmentally minded scientist parents. In 1988, at age 19, urgently inspired by the sudden death of an associate, she left her pre-naturopathic medical studies in university and made her way first to Europe and then on to India, entering monastic life as a white-robed Anagarika, and then 2 years later undertaking 10 precept nuns' ordination. Wishing to connect with the ancient lineage of the Bhikkhuni Sangha, she sought and found her female mentor in Buddhist monastic life in South Korea, the most venerable Bhikkhuni elder, Myeongseong Sunim, who gave her the name Tataloka and went on to train under her mentorship for 10 years. Returning to the United States in 1996 with her Bhikkhuni mentor's blessing, in 1997 in Los Angeles with an international gathering of bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, dharma teachers and supporters in attendance, she received Bhikkhuni higher ordination from Sri Lankan Bhikkhu Sangha led by her preceptor, the Venerable Dr. Avanapola Ratnasara Nayaka Mahatero. Since then, Venerable Tataloka has focused on meditation and on both the study and practice of Dhamma and Vinaya. Her meditation training in Theravada Buddhism has been largely with the masters of the Thai forest traditions, stemming from Ajahn Mun Buridatta, Ajahn Mahabua, and teachers of the Ajahn Chah tradition, together with Burmese mindfulness and insight masters of Sayadaw Upandita's tradition and meditation master Paok Sayadaw. Overall, her practice and teachings are profoundly influenced by the Buddha's own advice and injunctions as contained in the early Buddhist suttas. Recognizing the growing number of Theravadan bhikkhunis and samaneris in the United States and the true value of coming together in harmony, Ayat Tataloka proposed and participated in the founding of the North American Bhikkhuni Association in 2004. Several months later, she also participated in founding the first residential community for bhikkhunis in the Western United States, named Dhammadharani. Ayat Tataloka is the first Western woman to be appointed as a Theravada Bhikkhuni preceptor, and she has contributed to the going forth and full ordination of more than 50 women as nuns in the USA, Australia, India and Thailand. Ayat Tataloka's primary role is as the founding abbess and preceptor of both the Dhammadharani Monastery at the western foot of the Sonoma Mountain in Pengrove and the Aranyabodhi Awakening Forest Hermitage in the Sonoma Coast in Northern California, where she provides Dhamma and meditation teaching and guidance and monastic mentorship. And since 2021, she's been actively involved in the United Theravada Bhikkhuni Sangha International Working Group, together with other international Bhikkhuni preceptors and leaders of Theravada traditions. Ayat Tataloka has been blazing a trail in various other ways, and I've left a list of more of achievements in the description below. And right now, we are so fortunate to have Ayat Tataloka here on this podcast to learn about her spiritual journey, which has been pivotal opening up the path to higher ordination for women across several Western countries. I'm so glad you've chosen to join us to hear this inspiring story. Treasure Mountain, Aya. How are you today?
Greetings, Sol. It's nice to be here with you. And it is it's a beautiful afternoon with sunshine in the mountain forest in the redwoods here at Aranyabodhi Awakening Forest Hermitage. Thank you for inviting me.
I believe that you're about to go on a meditation retreat, a personal meditation retreat. Is that so?
Yes, coming up soon. I'll have some time of silent, secluded, personal meditation retreat here in the forest. This is actually one of my favorite times of the year, to have this time here, and I feel immensely fortunate due to the gift of use of this several hundred acres of forest land that it's possible to have this time here, just with this rescued, regrowing redwood forest and all the animals and, you know, safe from humans, but practicing in the way that the Buddha had taught with regards to our own bodies and minds. And then also, you know, we have mountain lions and rattlesnakes, maybe a bear or two. So, you know, working with fear and dread and these kinds of things, you know, loving kindness in the forest. It's a great opportunity that we have here, and I'm glad to have it personally, and I'm glad to be able to share that with all the other members of our monastic community here, the bhikkhunis and seminaries and aspirants and those who have drawn near during this time of the Vasa this year.
It's wonderful to see that you're continuing that very old Buddhist tradition of preserving natural forest and the animals that live there, but also, of course, engaging in that meditative tradition as well. And I have to say, when I was looking through your list of things that you're engaged in, I mean, I read the list and I felt tired just reading it. So I'm so pleased that you're getting the chance to have a retreat.
Well, you know, that list is over a few years' time. I've been in monastic life for more than 30 years. So when you spread out activities over that length of time and then, and then list them out, then it can add up. But I'm really glad in this time of life that it is absolutely interspersed with so much time of quiet and seclusion. Please go ahead.
Well, I just thought it'd be a great place for our conversation to start, to go back to the beginning of your spiritual journey, in this lifetime at least. What was the spark that sent you on this journey as a young woman, to which ended in you in ordaining?
Well, you know, it's really hard to say. People have asked me that question many times before, and even as a young person, as a kid, when I heard things, sayings that were attributed to the Buddha, you know, I remember many times really just stopping. Like, it wasn't just the same old ordinary that I heard all the time. Like stopping, pausing to look into that, and feeling that there was something special there. And I know even as a very young teenager, then I heard about somebody who had gone forth, you know, from their personal experience, an associate of my family who had gone to Thailand to work, I think, with the Peace Corps, some kind of water irrigation project. And then afterwards took the opportunity to ordain for 3 months, which was still really widely practiced in Thailand at that time. And, you know, he said that that was better than anything else, to have that opportunity to really just devote himself to the Adisila, higher ethics, moral virtue, and Adichitta, or meditation, and Adipanya, to really be learning and studying and contemplating the Buddha's teaching. And so then, even as a young teenager, when I heard about that, I felt like, can I go? I asked, like, that's what I want to do. I just thought straight off. And, you know, during that time, one of my favorite TV shows was called Kung Fu with David Carradine. And, you know, just the paradigm of, like, living life as a seeker and meeting every opportunity and all kinds of challenges, reflecting back on the wisdom of the Buddha's teaching, and then applying that in the situations of life as a kind of like as a wandering seeker. That was something that I just felt, you know, really strong affinity with there. But in that conversation with a friend of the family, when I said, I want to go, then not only did my parents say, oh, we think you'd better finish high school first, but also he said, but I'm sorry to say that opportunity is available for the guys, but I didn't see it being available like that for the girls or for women. And that was really a kind of profound and turning moment for me, I think, because I had read books. I got all the books on Buddhism that I could out of my local library, which was maybe like three or four of them. And I'd read some old texts that somehow made their way into our family library from the Pali Text Society. And then I had this strong, clear idea that I felt sure was correct from the ancient text that the Buddha did have women disciples who were completely enlightened and who were part of his monastic community and who were teachers and leaders and who, you know, were just a part, an essential part of the, like, the early Buddhist community founded by the Buddha himself. And so when I had heard about this experience in Thailand and that this was like not like Zen Buddhism, but this Theravada is like a branch of the, you know, early Buddhist teachings and living like close to the way of the Buddha, that that's what it was all about, then I had these profound moments of cognitive dissonance. And then the question came up, so, you know, say what? So, like, how do these things connect if this is the early Buddhist way, but you're saying this? And so, you know, then to understand why, like, what happened loomed large in my mind. And I think that's one of the things that then led me later on to really get into studying Buddhist monastic history or history of the Bhikkhuni Sangha, which is something I worked with in graduate school. One of my main focuses in comparative Bhikkhuni Vinaya, and just to try to understand like what happened and what is going on here. But not so long after that, then we got news about another friend of the family or friend of a friend who ordained as a Buddhist monk. She ordained as a Buddhist monk at Shasta Abbey, which was south of where I was living and north of where we're at now. And when I heard that, like, she ordained as a Buddhist monk, then again, I said, what? Right. That's my Buddha, right? So then I realized that in some traditions, there were these opportunities when I found out more about that, and in some traditions, not. But I really felt, I'd say, like, allied with the Buddha in a way, with the places where the traditions had passed down these opportunities for women, and I'd say for girls, whether a young teenager would be called a woman or a girl, I don't know, but a teen. And so that was, you know, that was quite a turning moment in terms of my own, say, like, orientation and trajectory and intention. And that's been active up till now. It wasn't, though, until a few years later.
I'm curious.
Wandering monastics and having a direct experience, direct encounter with monastics and encountering the Buddha's Four Noble Truths, especially, that I really got galvanized to action, that is, to entering monastic life.
And what was that path? So you were in school in the United States, you had contact with other people, you had a lot of interest, but What was the path to ordination? I believe you went through Europe and some time in India. What was that path like until you finally did ordain?
Well, you know, as you mentioned in my bio, there was the time when I was in university and I was studying pre-naturopathic medicine. And so the pre-med part, you know, and the naturopathic medicine part, it brought up a lot of ideals and it brought up a lot of questions, like, where does suffering come from? And is there any way to really deal with it effectively in human life? Is it all really just band-aids, or is there anything more deep that can be done? So my fellow students and teachers and colleagues, we had discussions about these things. And it was in this context that someone mentioned the Four Noble Truths. And having read quite a lot of books related to Buddhism before, it's kind of surprising that it's only then that I really clearly heard the Four Noble Truths, but it was absolutely addressing this very question and issue. And in such a way that I felt like for some moments, like my world, whole world stopped and just centered on that. And there were so many things that I heard during that time from medicine and philosophical discussions that you just really have to, like, kind of hold at a distance and feel, you know, so much, like, credulous, so much doubt about, and like, wonder, is that true? Is that really possible? you know, so many things of doubt and question. And I never in my life until that point heard something that I actually felt so deeply, so much confidence in. I just felt like as I heard it, like, this rings true. And then, you know, my credulous mind, of course, came up and said, you know, right. but I felt like if it could be true, even from my intellectual mind, that it was worth it to give my life to the methods taught by the Buddha to prove it, to see, does it really work like this? And if so, I felt like, what could be more important? This is like the jackpot in a way. And I'll say also at that time then, I was doing some research work with regards to my schooling, my education, and my research then was on the cases where people receive a false fatal diagnosis, or people who should have received a fatal diagnosis and didn't. And, you know, there are just a surprising number of cases at that time, the things weren't all computerized, where people received a fatal diagnosis wrongly, and they died. And so, you know, I just studied these cases, and it just really, it made me very interested in the power of the mind and how what we're thinking is determining our experience of the world, not only mentally, but like what the impacts of what we have going on in our mind are on our bodies as well. So, you know, that was just that study really led me to believe that the mind is really important, much more so than was generally thought at that time.
I can imagine it would do. And when you're doing like medical studies, often the focus is on saving the body, and yet, and the mind doesn't exist. But here you are finding these huge anomalies that point to the, I guess, the importance of the mind, not just the existence of the mind, but the importance of the mind. I'd like to skip ahead a little bit. One of the things that I find really interesting about your story, as far as I know it, is that you are now a Theravadin bhikkhuni, but you spent quite a lot of time with a teacher in Korea, Myeong Seong Soo-nim. I'm trying to, this is really interesting. How did it come to be that you were in Korea in the first place? What was training in Korea like?
Well, thank you for asking. Myeongsang means bright star. And my venerable bhikkhuni mentor, Myeongsang Sunim, is still alive. She's elderly now. She's actually exactly the same age as Ajahn Sumedho. Longpo Sumedho went to visit the monastery where I trained with her, and she was she always remembered that she's the same age as him. During the time I was in university in the United States, there were a couple of really powerful women Dhamma teachers who were teaching here in the Western United States. One of them was Aya Kema, and another was Ruth Dennison. And so I'd have to say that those two, who are both passed away now, you know, their example was really important for me. And as you may know, then Aya Kema, after being a 10-precept nun for a number of years in the Sri Lankan traditions, then chose to fully ordain in 1988 here in the U.S. West Coast in California. And so that was a really big deal at that time. The senior bhikkhu who was later, not my intention, but who is later to become my own preceptor for my bhikkhuni ordination, actually was a big part of bringing 10 precept nuns from Sri Lanka, and then also from Nepal, and then also Aya Kema, and there were two from Germany who came. For I think a total of 12 Theravada nuns who then received full ordination in 1988. And so I'll just say there are things that were happening during that time that were really strong, and you know, we're experiencing the benefits of those initiatives even now very much. And one was the founding of Shakyadita, International Buddhist Women's Association, in 1987 in India. And the other then was that first full bhikkhuni ordination, and the attempts to try to figure out, like, for the revival of the Theravada Bhikkhuni Sangha, like, for the methods available, how to do that. And 1988 was a big first step, a big first try. So, you know, those things were live and happening at that time, that I myself then went forth first as an Anagarika in white, and with a few years in Europe, and then going to India. I have to say that before internet, just remembering back to that time, before being able to do a Google search, the things were just so different. So I had read old books about Buddhism in India, but I didn't actually really clearly know or understand what the state of the Sangha was in India at the time that I went there. I was learning about that on the ground. And so, you know, that was really quite surprising and shocking in a way, because we'd heard from teachers about, like, Buddhist masters in India, and I'd heard about Dipa Ma, who I then tried to go see, but she had just passed away just before that. So, wow, things were really different at that time. But there were, by the time I made my way to India, there were still, like, waves from the first Shakyadita conference, which were spreading out in the world and spreading around in India. So I understood that there was a strong call at that time. I got the message that there were senior Buddhist masters, leaders of traditions like His Holiness the Dalai Lama or the Cambodian International Patriarch Paramahagosananda, who later became a teacher of mine, calling for research and to go to the places where there were ancient Bhikkhuni Sanghas that still existed, and to do the research and to see, is there a way to reconnect these traditions where they were lost? And so I myself was one of those who picked that up. I heard at that time about the challenges that scholars faced, that sometimes to research inside the Bhikkhunis communities for scholars at that time was practically impossible. But I felt for myself as a monastic, they were saying what it really would take is somebody to go in and just enter monastic life there from the beginning and just learn from the inside on the ground. Over, a decade, right? And then they would be able to say what's really going on in there. And I heard that and I felt yes, I can do that. Other people who are scholars and have families and things like that, not sure. But that was just a movement in my heart and my mind thinking like that. But when I was in India, then, there were teachers, as also there were in Sri Lanka, who were giving 10 precept ordination and then saying this for you will be your full ordination and you can study Bhikkhuni Vinaya and practice as much as you can, but this is what we can do. And so I received 10 precept ordination at that time, and I actually didn't clearly understand, as many people still don't, what's the difference between being a 10 precept nun and being a seminary or being a bhikkhuni? Is there really any difference? And when I started to study Bhikkhuni Vinaya, though, I could tell that without being a bhikkhuni and without having bhikkhuni's communities, that there's just so much of the Vinaya teachings and training that's there that you're not able to practice unless you're actually ordained and you're part of a community of those who are ordained. But I got offered the chance of one or another of two cheap tickets out of India. As the way things goes, sometimes it just ends up determined by somebody who shows up as a donor and offers something, and that turns your whole world and your life for the rest of your life. Always happens so many times like that. So somebody offered a ticket either to Bangkok or to Hong Kong. And from what I'd heard about Thailand at that time, I felt like I heard things about great forest masters and, really admirable things about opportunities for practice for men. And I was told for myself, going as a female, it was suggested that I could go for 6 months and then I could go back to the US and work for 6 months. And then I could come back and put on white robes again for another 6 months, because I would be expected to be not only supporting myself, but also supporting the monastery and making offerings. And at that time, I felt like I had already entered into the renunciate path. And the idea of going back to working for 6 months and practicing for 6 months just did not sit right with me. That felt like that would be taking 10 steps backwards, and I had already left home life. And so then that was real kind of game changer for me. And so I took the ticket to Hong Kong, and then I used Hong Kong as my base with month by month visas for 2 years to go and travel around to these various places where there are Bhikkhunis communities throughout East Asia, and to check them out and to see what was going on there. That's what eventually then led me to South Korea. Because I went to Taiwan and I went into China and I went to see what was going on in Japan and Macau. I really felt then when I finally got an invitation to go to visit Korea, when I heard about and saw the mountain forest meditation traditions in Korea that just seemed so much more in line with where my heart was at. In Taiwan, there was a lot of bowing, a lot of repentance, a lot of emphasis on vegetarianism, a lot of chanting of Buddha's and Bodhisattva's names and bright colors and playing of monastic instruments. And just for me, that wasn't the type of culture that I was really interested in. But mountain forest hermitages, meditation, that seemed much more like my cup of tea. Plus, I heard on what we then called the Dhamma Bum Circuit, when I was on a ferry, actually, between Japan and somewhere, I was on a ferry, and then just talking with some other, met some Dhamma people, some meditators who were traveling there, and they told me about in Korea. They said at that time, they said that that was the place where there was like the best opportunity for women for training, ordination, meditation, teaching, any kind of project that you might like to have in Buddhism, that was just all open there in that circumstance. And they told me they had gone to a Dhamma talk. This is a guy. He told me he had gone to a Dhamma talk at the main temple of the Joge Order in Seoul, in the capital, and that there was a bhikkhuni up on the high seat in the main temple of the whole order giving a Dhamma talk. And he had, in all his travels around the world in Buddhism, he had never seen anything like that before. He was just, wow, so impressed. So I did not find out until years later, maybe even 10 or 11 years later, that that bhikkhuni in that story was actually the bhikkhuni Bright Star, Myeongseong Sunim, who became my venerable bhikkhuni mentor. I didn't know that was her. I just, when I met her, I connected with her and something very deep happened. I bowed 9 times without even thinking about why am I bowing 9 times. And then she just asked me, "You want to ordain, don't you?" And then she told me what her requirements would be for doing that. She really wanted me to learn everything from the ground up. She felt like if there was a chance as a Westerner that I might be able to do something for Westerners or for the greater situation, she was really aware of what was going on, like in Thailand and Sri Lanka and in Theravada Buddhism, as well as in Tibetan or Himalayan Buddhism and ordination. She was very much aware of that. And she did not want to have it be just like hit and run in ordination, to like just come in and get ordained and then be out there. She wanted me to be able to learn everything from, from the bottom up, to be able to know all of it. And she thought that could really help with like putting down the root, if it were possible to revive these bhikkhuni's traditions, which she was very much in support of. She felt like it needed to have a deep root, to not just be like superficial, like just with the patchwork robe and the ordination ceremony, but that it needed to go deep. And so I took on that commitment with her.
That's really an amazing story, and it just tells us so much about the obstacles that were faced, because it seems to me like you had a very sincere wish to be part of a Buddhist meditative tradition, not just the obstacles but also the opportunities. But I also find it interesting, it seems to me like that connection with Bright Star, that seems to me like it almost, because I was going to ask, what's the difference between the practical difference between this Mahayana tradition in South Korea and with Theravada? And in some ways, I'm getting the feeling it's a superficial question. Would you agree with that? Like, when it comes to a meditative tradition, it's almost like the superficial differences blend you know, just disappear or blend away. What's your perspective as someone who has lived these different meditative traditions?
Thank you for asking that. I absolutely agree that in some ways all these things are very much superficial, and in another way, not. For myself, although I had very much appreciation for living in the mountain forest hermitages and monasteries and for this tradition in which meditation was so strong, the type of meditation is actually quite different, or it was. These days, there's so much more early Buddhist teaching being taught in practice in Korea, I know. And that was already coming to be so 10 years after I had entered into monastic life there. When I returned again, there was just so much interest. And, you know, there's also the language of names and forms, which really dominates in the consciousness of, I think, the vast majority of the human beings. So there's the very deep part that transcends all of that. And also, in a way, what we wear or what name we have or, you know, which tradition we're allied with is something that people hold as being really important in the world of names and forms. If I think about the time that I returned more than 10 years later to Korea at my Venerable Bhikkhuni mentor's request and invitation. This is after my full ordination as a Bhikkhuni with the Sri Lankan Bhikkhu Sangha. And returning then, I met quite a lot of Bhikkhunis then in Korea who had strong interest and affinity in the early Buddhist teachings and their practices, as I did. And some of them had gone to Burma, and, you know, wearing the robes of a, say, quote-unquote Mahayana bhikkhuni, then they could go to Burma and practice together, and some people would accept them as a bhikkhuni and some not. But in a way, you know, it's like being in the guise or being in the disguise of a Mahayana bhikkhuni was what gave them the opportunity to do that. For those who really wanted to dedicate their lives completely to living and practicing in the way of the early Buddhist traditions or in the way that the teachings had been passed down and were being taught in Burma or Sri Lanka or Thailand, I know I heard again and again that for them there came to be a point where they felt like, you know, on the outside, it's like they're being supported by a community that's supporting Mahayana Buddhism and wearing the robes that are associated with Mahayana Buddhism, but that's not what's going on with their hearts and minds and their practice and the way that they're living and feeling a kind of a, you know, like something doesn't jive there. And then even sometimes feeling like, you know, needing to be like hush hush for the support of the community because of being supported by these communities, and like don't talk about what you're doing because the people are thinking they're supporting something Mahayana, and then that starts to feel even like maybe dishonest, right? And so I think there's a wish that I see in a lot of monastics for congruity, for where their hearts and minds are and the way that they wish to be living and practicing, for that to be well aligned with the forms. And then the what you see outside then for those who seem to be doing that, at least for me, then I would see like what I felt allied with. Then was being expressed in, it seemed like, with congruity, in alliance or in harmony by those who were ordained in Theravada traditions and wearing the robes of the Theravada traditions and with the names and, you know, the sense of belonging associated with those traditions. And so there's a point in our regular chanting in Pali that says Satang Sabhyanjanang Kewala Paripunang Parisutang Brahmachariang Paka Sesi. And so this is talking about then a special quality of the Buddha. This is speaking about the, you'd say, like salient qualities of the Buddha and how he established his Sangha. And so it's talking about both the essence and also the particulars as being like very much allied in harmony and like fully manifest and being fulfilled. So not being at disparity with one another. So not like essence is one thing and form is something else. Of course, that's, again, that's true in a way. But like the vision is that what the Buddha was, how he lived and how the early Buddhist Sangha lived, it's about as close as you can get in human life to having the, you know, both the form and the expressions and all of the particulars and that essence aligned with one another. And so I felt that myself. And I saw so many others who felt like that. And they said, like, if the opportunity was there, they were seeing in South Korea, then some of them, we were seeing some of those who were their bhikkhu brothers. Then when they felt like, this is where my heart lies, this is where my practice lies, this is what I want to teach, they just, you know, go for a dalikamma. Ceremony or reordination, and then they're just accepted by the Bhikkhu Sangha and then they live in that way. But for those women who were bhikkhunis, then that path was not clearly open to do that like that. So it's like the bhikkhus were able to follow their hearts, and that seemed like that had integrity. And those then bhikkhunis who also had hearts for such integrity and congruity in their lives, then the way was not clear at that time. So it seemed like, if possible, let's open that back up again. Because it, for what's healthy and wholesome and even liberating, if the way is blocked, then, and you can open it, then open it internally and externally in the forms in the world.
Absolutely. That's a really interesting story. And I guess the next question would have to be, well, you were very much a part of opening that blockage and furthering the bhikkhuni ordination. Now, obviously, there were some that came before you, but I'd like to focus on how you went back to the United States and the circumstances surrounding your higher ordination as a bhikkhuni.
Yes. So, you know, I had been accepted and I undertook the training in South Korea. And so then the plan was that I would be fully ordained there. And then, as it turned out, I accidentally broke visa law. And so then when I went to renew my visa in South Korea, they said no, and they expatriated me back to the United States. This was after I had received, anyway, so much, in a way, like so much investment in this initiative, right? And so I went back to the beginning and I donned the Korean robes, and then I was accepted for Pabaja with my venerable bhikkhuni mentor, Myeongsang Sunim, and her community, and then went for the national seminary training, education and training, and received the seminary precepts and all of that. And then, you know, within a year after that, then I went to the immigration office in Daegu and they were just not having any of it. So this is kind of just, in a way, you know, the luck of the draw at that time. If if my local immigration office were in Seoul, then there were plenty of Western monks and this wouldn't have happened. But in Daegu, there weren't any other Western Buddhist monastics who were trying to get their visas there. And at that time, the office was staffed by people who were kind of fundamentalist Christians mostly, and then who believed that like Buddhism is like the work of the devil, and thought that at that time like the US is the Christian Western pure land, and so for a Westerner to be like there in Buddhist monastic robes, they felt was something really horrific. So much so that the officer who saw me turned white, started shaking, left his desk, and did not come back. So, because he was just scared and so upset. So, you know, eventually they were able to get somebody to come back. But then the thing about like discovering, seeing that I had accidentally, completely accidentally, broken the terms of my visa, they were just not going to consider about that, and it's just that was the end of it. And I found myself then heading back to the United States. And so this was an enormous situation then of letting go, because I had invested so much of my hopes and dreams and efforts into this. And then, you know, I'm on a flight back to, and then I got sent back to California, which is not my hometown. And then being a solo female novice arriving in a state that's not my home state. Like, okay, I'm back
in
my home
country.
What
do you do? It's crazy.
My dream is crushed. I'm separated from my teacher, my community, my commitment, all that. And yeah, like what to do? And so I needed to really recalibrate and regroup and consider, okay, now what? And I think in a way, if I look back, like that seemed so disorienting, and yet I did have the Buddhist teaching. And so I felt like, okay, profound opportunity for letting go. And then letting go that I'm not going to be able to force this. I cannot make this happen with the conditions as they are. So let go and then reorient and see what happens. And so what ended up happening then is something that I couldn't even before really like dare to dream of being possible for myself. During that year that I was a novice in Korea, I got to meet who was going to become Venerable Bhikkhuni Kusuma, the first of the Sri Lankan Bhikkhunis, and I got to meet the Korean Bhikkhuni leaders who were trying to support then the 1996 Sarnath Bhikkhuni ordination. And my own Venerable Bhikkhuni mentor and others who were her peers were in support of that. So Venerable Bhikkhuni Kusuma, then Kusuma Devendra and Ranjani De Silva, like where they were studying in Seoul. And so that was happening during that 1 year then after my seminary precepts in Korea. And even I had asked, like, can I go for this ordination in India? I was in India, right? And their understanding was this was for Sri Lankans. This is something that was being done exclusively for a handpicked group of picked by Shakyadita Sri Lanka in conjunction with the Mahabodhi Society in India, and that then, you know, they were going to be in India for a couple of years studying after the ordination if it worked out, if it went ahead, which it did. So, you know, that was something that was happening at that time that was within my awareness and I like touched on. And so it all seemed very, very iffy, like what's going to happen with that. And that was, as I said, that was what I heard when I asked about it, like, can I do that? was this is for Sri Lankan. And you have made your commitment to this path, to this way here now, which is just as good and equally as good and will also work for you. And this is the commitment you made with your teacher and all that. So I was, okay, yes, I did. All right. But then the visa thing happened. And so then 1996 right. ordination.
But happened. The visa thing happened, brought you.
Yeah. That...
Yeah, yeah, this is so there's so many different currents going on at the time. It's a very complex story.
It brought me to California, surprisingly, which was then right where Venerable Havampola Ratanasara Mahatero, who was to become my bhikkhu preceptor, where he and other Sri Lankan monks, including monks who were also involved in supporting the 1996 ordination, Venerable Dr. Walpola Piananda was there offering the robes for the 1996 ordination. So what happened is somehow that underlying intention that I had, this is my analysis now, that underlying intention that I had somehow in the moral arc of the universe then put me right where the thing that I was really, like, if you could say, what is your ideal, that the closest possible thing in the world to that, unbeknownst to me, was being thought of and planned. And immigration then put me right back in the state where that was being planned, and then where the invitation was put out to those women, especially those who had been like more than 5 years or 10 years in monastic life, but who hadn't been able to fully ordain and who wished to fully ordain. Like, the invitation was put out to apply for this ordination, which I did. And letters and phone calls with my Venerable Bhikkhuni mentor, then she gave her blessings and approval to that. I think she very much sympathized. So I joined in the training for that ordination. And it was planned to be a dual ordination and different than in 1996. In this case, for the dual ordination, the plan was that the first part with the Bhikkhuni Sangha is going to be done according to the Dharmaguptaka tradition. But then the second part with the Bhikkhu Sangha is going to be done according to the Theravada Pali text tradition. So that was a big question, like, can you do that? Can you mix the two traditions together like that? And the theory behind it was that's absolutely the best that you could do, because it's respecting the existing bhikkhunis and existing bhikkhuni sanghas, and they have their own sanghakamma. And then also the Bhikkhu Sangha, Theravada, you know, Pali text Sanghakamma, they have their own Sanghakamma. And according to the Theravada Pali text, and pretty much, you know, all Sanghakammas or these kinds of things work, is for ordinations, is like the most recent thing is considered to be the most valid thing, right? So, I mean, that's the basis for if a Korean bhikkhu goes and is reordained in Sri Lanka, that's the whole basis for the idea, then he becomes a Theravada monk. It's because that next Sanghakamma with the Theravada Sangha is then considered to supersede or to predominate and to become the contemporary one. So that's the doctrinal underpinnings of why that's considered to work like that. And that was their idea. That was what the plan was. So I did the training there and had the wonderful opportunity to get to know Venerable Dr. Ratanasara in what was to be the last years of his life. The Bikuni Sangha was there and like testing and training and all of that. But on the day of the ordination, then there were five Bikunis who were invited. I have to say, as a preceptor, then like, don't just invite five Bikunis or five Bikus. You always want to have some extras. Yeah. Because anything can happen. Yeah. And on that day, anything did happen. So on that day, it turned out there was no Bikuni quorum because one of those Bikunis got sick, seriously sick with flu and was not able to come. Yes. And another Bikuni was not available on short notice. And so I had gone through all of those preparations with the Bikuni Sangha. And like we walked through the exam and everything like that, but then there was no Bikuni Sangha Kama. There was just the Bhikkhu Sangha Kama for the ordination. That was 25 years ago this year. So then again, what happened was not what was planned and not what we were aiming for. But what happened was something that had been very seriously considered by a number of like great elders and bhikkhu scholars. That is like, can the bhikkhu sangha just give the ordination? And in those moments where there were like 200 sangha members gathered together in the Sima, in the Ananda Sima Hall, and one bhikkhuni is missing, then my late most venerable bhikkhu preceptor, Venerable Havampola Ratanasara, Nayaka Mahatero, who was to become the Sri Lankan chief prelate for the Western Hemisphere, he just recited from his memory, directly from the Pali Canon, the Buddha's allowance for the bhikkhus to give bhikkhunis ordination, together with a number of other things. And he just, in his authority in those moments, and he was extremely knowledgeable about the Buddha's teaching. I just say just absolutely incredible in terms of what he just held ready in working memory. There are few people in the world like that. And he had great presence and charisma and was enormously respected. So he's leading up the College of Buddhist Studies very nearby at that time. And so he said, this is what we can do. The Buddha allowed it. And then they did it. So there were four Sri Lankan bhikkhus who were there, and also four Thai bhikkhus who had been invited who were there. So like a Sri Lankan bhikkhu sangha and Thai bhikkhu sangha, as well as the monastics of other traditions who were there. But they just went ahead with the Theravada Pali text Sangha Kama for us. So myself and then two others, one previously Bikuni from Nepal and another from Sri Lanka. Then we received the Bikuni Upasampada together. And then there was one Sri Lankan relative of Venerable Dr. Ratanasara's who also received Bhikkhu ordination there together at that time. So again, what happened was like something that had been being considered for even since like the Mingun Jetawan Sayadaw in the teacher of Mahasi Sayadaw in Burma, when he analyzed the situation, like that's what he proposed as to be what he thought was the best, most authentic method for reviving the Theravada Bikuni Sangha. And I could not have myself, I couldn't imagine or dream that that might be a possibility for me. And then it's just the way that things turned on that day in November 25 years ago. That's just how it happened.
That is the most incredible story. Like, it brings so much together about the currents within modern Buddhism, which are trying to reconnect to early Buddhism, but also this powerful story of trying to reestablish the Bhikkhuni Sangha, which is, I guess, part of the modern Buddhist Renaissance, and all these elements of chance, which just, that's incredible. That is an absolutely incredible story, I have to say. And I want to say thank you very much for sharing that story. I am not even halfway through the questions that I wanted to ask today, but I do feel like we probably ought to draw this to a close. But I really want to say that is just an incredible story, and I really want to find out more. I have to ask you to come back again at a later date.
Well, Saul, you know, I know you have editorial power. I know also, or I think I know, that you need to go to work later on today. So I just want to say for myself, I have time right now. I don't know the circumstances in the future, I think we need to preserve your job. And if there's anything else that you would like to ask right now, then I have the time right now. And if you'd like to have a part two for this at some time in the future, who knows the circumstances and conditions, what they will be, but I would be happy to think about that too.
I do thank you for that offer. I am going to have to leave, as I do have to preserve my day job, but I do want to say that that story is incredible, and I hope it's one that really gets out there, because it is one of those, I think, pivotal moments that really opened up the door, not just for yourself, but for a lot of other women who want to take on the monastic path. What I really would like to know more about, which is what I'd hoped to ask, was just about your work in spreading the ordination and your work both east and west, but particularly in the United States. That's a whole other story, but I think I will have to leave it at this point in time.
Yes, well, thank you for mentioning that, and yes, that's the other story. And what you just mentioned is, in fact, something that has been really, I'd say, like the guide star for me. And that is, I feel like somehow, you know, whether, I don't think it's just by chance, actually. I feel like they're the deep underlying kind of karmic causal conditions that are at play there. I really saw, like, wow, somehow I got through this. And I've been able to do what even I didn't imagine. I mean, you know, just maybe in my own dreams, right? But I didn't really think could be possible. Somehow I've been able to do this. And is there a way I got through these cracks myself? And is there a way to bring some others through as well? Can we widen the cracks? And can we even break through to the point where this is not like breaking through rock or asphalt, but this becomes like the well-tilled field, the fertile ground for cultivation that the Buddha is describing as his Sangha? So, you know, that's where that comes from.
Well, I just want to conclude by thanking you for having that confidence and faith to stick with it, because it sounded like it was a real roller coaster ride to get to where you are now. And thank you very much for taking the time to come on Treasure Mountain Podcast today. Thank you very much. Thank you to all our listeners for joining us for this inspiring episode of Treasure Mountain with Ayatatarloka, a nun at the forefront of developing the Bhikkhuni Sangha in the West and the Buddhist community of practice more broadly in the United States. I want to emphasize that the unfolding of the Buddha Sasana in the West is only just getting started, and that outstanding examples of renunciation and dedication to spiritual practice, like that of Ayatatarloka and the nuns of Dhammatarani Monastery in California, are going to have an influence on our society for a long time to come. I'd encourage you to find out more about Dhammatarani Monastery and to offer support to the nuns there, which can be done by following the links in the description below. Also, you can find out more about the Treasure Mountain podcast by going to treasuremountain.info website, where you can find all the previous episodes and information about all our guests. If you enjoy this podcast, you can subscribe to Treasure Mountain podcast using your favorite podcast app in order to get notified about future episodes. And don't forget to tell your friends about Treasure Mountain too. I'll have more inspiring guests and topics in the coming weeks, starting with a second part of Ayatatarloka's interview, which is coming up next. Until then, I wish you all the best on your spiritual voyage.